Blog Talk Radio.
Did you know there's a secret place to expand your mind? A place to escape the same old negative news? Welcome to Colombo Chronicles Live with Rose Colombo, award-winning author, cable TV and radio host, poet, and advocate for justice. Rose has been seen and heard on local and national TV and radio. She's consulted with victims of injustice for more than 20 years. Her articles have been published in major and local newspapers and magazines. Listen live as Rose Colombo welcomes prominent authors and experts to her podcast every Wednesday from noon to 1 p.m. Pacific Time at blogtalkradio.com/Colombo Chronicles. You can call in and ask questions at 646-564-9742. Follow Rose Colombo every Wednesday from 12 noon to 1 p.m. on Colombo Chronicles Live at blogtalkradio.com/Colombo Chronicles.
Colombo Chronicles Live. Colombo is on their trail. Listen up at Colombo Chronicles Live.
Hi, everyone. It's the Rose. Welcome back. It's Wednesday, January 26th, noon out here on the West Coast. And hope you're having a great day wherever you happen to be. Hey, I read today that the LA Times reports Supreme Court Justice Stephen G. Breyer is about to retire, and he will be giving President Biden his first appointment to the Supreme Court. And also on Epic Times, they report today that a doctor's organization has treated over 150,000 COVID-19 patients with a 99.99% survival rate. That is absolutely amazing and stunning. You want to read about that on the Epic Times. Excellent, excellent news reporting. And also in the news, many people will be happy, maybe others won't. President Biden's administration officially withdraws the vaccine rule so that employers don't have to make the decision any longer to cause their employees to be jabbed or else be tested frequently. So that was a court decision that came down just recently. And on another issue here, we are going to be entering into the world of authors and experts as we do every week. And we have a very popular and dynamic author with us today. And her name is Laurel Ann, and that's with an E, Laurel Ann Hill, and that's H-I-L-L. And she has written Plague of Flies, Revolt of the Spirits, 1846. Have you ever dreamed or imagined of living back in the day and Western days and pioneer days and when the country was new and people were changing and states were being formed and blah, blah, blah? Well, in 1846, Alta California, Catalina Delgado daydreams about her future, roping cattle, marrying Angelo Ortega, and raising children. And of course, back in the day, and actually up until 2000, that was the goal of females, is to go to school, graduate, get married, and have children, right? Things do change. But now invaders from the United States, the Bear Flaggers, have declared war against Mexico, her country, back in 1846. And the Bear Flaggers have imprisoned one close friend of her family and murdered others. So we'll ask her what fate might befall her parents, her grandfather, and younger brothers, and her best friend. And how can Catalina, only 16 years old, help protect all those she loves? Sounds like an exciting, exciting novel, does it not? Well, it is. And it's important not only for adults, but young adult readers as well, as she encourages young adult readers, teenagers, 14 and up, to read fiction. So we're going to ask her about that and why she's interested in more young people picking up a book and reading. And let me tell you a little bit about Laurel Ann Hill, the author of several award-winning books, in just a moment. And we're going to be back in just a moment. So don't touch that dial and listen to this important message.
Howdy, folks. Just stopped in by my favorite restaurant, the Horseshoe Cafe. I highly recommend the home-cooked hot meals and piping hot coffee. In fact, it reminds me of my mom's home cooking when I was growing up. The customer service is excellent. Be sure to save room for the world's best desserts. Make sure you try a slice of fresh homemade pie. The Horseshoe Cafe is located at 154 East 4th Street in the heart of Benson, Arizona. The Horseshoe Cafe is right outside of Tombstone, Sierra Vista, and Tucson. Sometimes Patty and Mike stop by to welcome you. The staff at the Horseshoe Cafe looks forward to seeing you. Stop by to eat or relax. Cool down in the desert with a cold beer or your favorite cocktail. That's the Horseshoe Cafe. Oh, and don't tell anyone I told you, but some people think it's haunted. One thing is for sure. Be sure to bring your appetite.
Columbo Chronicles Live. Columbo is on their trail. Listen up at Columbo Chronicles Live.
That's right. Listen up, because on Columbo Chronicles Live, we are about to enter into the world of authors and experts on part one. And we have a very popular dynamic guest with us today. And you won't want to miss Laurel Ann Hill, and that's Ann with an E. And Laurel Ann Hill is the author and former underground storage tank operator. She grew up in San Francisco with more dreams of adventure than good sense or money. Her close brushes with death, love, and family, respect of honor, and belief in a higher power continue to influence her writing and her life. Laurel has authored over 30 published short stories and 2 award-winning YA novels. Most recently, The Engine Woman's Light, The Gripping Spirits, Meeting Steampunk, Coming of Age, Heroic Journey of a Young Latina in an Alternate 19th Century California. The Engine Woman's Light has won a total of 13 honors and awards, including a Kirkus Star. That is a great achievement. Sand Hill Review Press is on schedule to publish Laurel's next YA novel, Plague of Flies, Revolt of the Spirit, 1846, which is here in 2022. So let's get started, enter into the world of authors and experts, and say hello to our very special guest. Hi, Laurel. How are you today?
I'm doing very well, Rose. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Well, I'm very happy to have you on our show today. And you know, this is an interesting era that you wrote about, 1846, because personally, I grew up with watching the Westerns on television and in the movies, and I still do. I just love them. So this is kind of intriguing to me. And so, Laurel, why don't you tell us a little bit about your background so our audience can be have a little more information about what you think and why you write these wonderful books.
Well, first of all, I write because I started out making up stories before I could even read, and my sister would write down my stories and I would decorate them with pictures I cut out from magazines and comic books. And so I started out writing early, so it meant a lot to me. But then I went into science, and I married, and I had a family. And, you know, that takes a lot of time, and I didn't get back to writing again as an adult until I was almost 50 years old. And at that point, I had a horrible illness. I had 24/7, you know, three muscle spasms in my back. And I thought I was never going to be able to get out of bed again, let alone write. And, of course, all the medication I was on made me have hallucinations. And when I hallucinated my version of the Grim Reaper saying I'd never get a chance to write, I promised myself that if I recovered from that illness, I would write. And I recovered, and I did.
That's an amazing story. And it just goes to show, you know, that even though sometimes life gives us a little detour or a big detour, that sometimes our dreams can still come true, and we may not be in that position forever as long as you have a belief in a higher power and a strong mind. And I'm so happy that you were healed and that you were able to pursue your dream. And so is that part of the reason why you it's important to you that young people and teenagers pick up a book and read?
Well, that's part of it. But a lot of it is just that when you read, you take in different information than when you watch. You've got to interpret the words. It goes through, I think it just makes your brain work harder. And I think we learn how to analyze situations better when we take in visually as well as just seeing stuff on a screen. Now, of course, people who are visually impaired have accentuation of their other senses because of it. And so they are taking in things differently when they hear them than they would when they would read them. But their senses are so heightened in other areas that I don't think that, you know, that they would suffer from that, you know, because you're still using your brain. But for us,
right,
those who can, you know, who have visual ability, I think it helps to look at the words and bring it in that way rather than just listening.
I agree with that. I think when you read a book, it's closer to you in mind, spirit, and body, and closer to the author than watching a movie and turning it off, because you're actually holding the book and you're seeing the author usually. And you can see the person who wrote it and a little bit of background about them. And it kind of brings you closer to the story and why they are writing the book that you're interested in. So tell us a little bit about your book, Plague of Flies. Who are the main characters? And is it mostly powerful women as the characters in your books?
Well, my main character is Catalina Delgado. And she is a teen in 1846. She's Hispanic, as they would have called themselves then. But essentially, she's a mestiza. And I really identify with Catalina. I absolutely love her. I love her because she's not some kind of a superhero. She's an ordinary teen of her time, and she's bound by the ordinary constraints that were placed on women in her society at that time, and she gets around things, as so many women did. And I love her boyfriend, Angelo. I mean, she's got a very, very strong mother who, you know, she's just known as Mama. Her father is both strong and weak, as all characters are. And I have, I mean, even her dear friend, who's a servant girl, and she's very, very close. Catalina is really close to Josefa, her servant girl. And she's also close to another girl in her own society, so to speak, Epiphania, their friends. And all these women have strong qualities or wisdom in one area or another. And this is important to me because I give my characters difficult tasks to accomplish. They have to be strong inside to get there, just as women in my family had to be strong to survive. And so I really believe in the strength of women, and I think it's important to write about that.
That's fantastic. And so what would men do without women, right? They wouldn't be here.
Well, women would have a hard time, too, without men. I think it's a good relationship, and it varies from society to society.
Yes, it does. And, you know, you began researching your family history, and you discovered rumors that startled you about the railroad and the land and that your family once owned. So what is that all about?
Okay. My father kept on thinking of himself as California Spanish as well as Scotch-Irish. So he never said much about his family to me because he sort of separated from them, so to speak, as a young man. He wanted to go off to sea, and they didn't want him to. And his older brothers pulled him off the boat, and he never quite forgave him after that.
Oh.
And so that I never really learned much about them. And so when I discovered my great-grandmother's papers, her scrapbook, a very small journal, and family photographs in the California Historical Society, I was just so enthusiastic and inspired about this. And that was, I mean, I was in my 60s by the time that I learned this. I can't believe it. But I lucked out, so to speak, and I learned about them. And I wanted to write about my great-grandparents, or if I couldn't write about them, I wanted to honor them by my writing. Now, I had started writing Catalina's story before I knew much about my great-grandparents. And so Catalina had already established herself in her head, in my head. And so mm-hmm. I couldn't just stop writing about her, because once you've established a character that way, or at least that's the way my mind works, if I was to say, forget it, Catalina, I'm going to write something about my great-grandparents, she would have never let me get another night's sleep. Because the characters start getting after you in your brain. So
right.
I had to finish her story, and now I'm working on a story that it's not my great-grandparents' story, because I write fantasy, but it is inspired by the fact that a widow with two daughters has to come from Mexico up into California in the 1860s.
That's a great story. So you also write about the spirits provide Catalina with answers, but not ones she wants. And plus, she fears a strange spirit man who rides a black Andalusian stallion through the sky. And for the sake of all she holds dear, Catalina must risk her reputation as a chaste young woman. So there's romance in this book as well.
Oh, yes, and she is in love with Angelo, but Angelo's father does not want the two to marry because of her reputation has been tarnished because of rumors that she will be carried away by a spirit man someday. And this rumor was started by an old vaquero. who used to watch over her safety when she was a little girl.
Wow, that's intriguing right there. So did you write this book as part of your Mexican heritage, or did you have feelings about exposing some of the positive and negative and family truths, but also fictionalizing it into the book at all?
Well, what I did was, I mean, one of the things that I learned when I did research into my family and I found my great-grandmother's papers, I found out that she had been a poet. And it might be more like a closet poet, because women in her society in those days did not write things to be sold. They wrote them for themselves personally or to share with the family. So she was a poet, and only one of her poems has survived. She mm-hmm. and my great-grandfather was a journalist, among other things. He was part diplomat, part land salesman, and he was a journalist. And great-grandpa personally, almost single-handedly, started another armed altercation between Mexico and the United States, because a journalist in Texas slandered him. The journalist in Texas had the bad sense to go down into Mexico after that, and great-grandpa had him thrown in a Mexican jail. And so that's where it started, and it literally ended up, from what I've read in old newspaper reports, that there were troops on the other side of the border and that the whole episode had come to the attention of the President of the United States, and oh my gosh, great-grandpa's caused a stir. So
that's
with those characters
story.
In mind, now, how am I not going to write and honor them? But, of course, I started Plague of Flies in honor of my family. I finished Plague of Flies in honor of my husband, David, of 42 years, who passed away before I finished the first draft of the book. It took me literally years. There was a separation of time for many, many years after I started the book, and I got to a point and I couldn't finish it. It didn't work. I couldn't figure it out. And then when I lost David, I went through such emotional turmoil that I identified so much more with Catalina and her emotional turmoil that the words just started to flow out on the page. It took me all those years, you know, maybe 10 years or so, to write the first half of the book, first draft. It took me 3 months to write the second half of the book, the first draft.
Yes, I can totally relate to that. I mean, people think you just sit down, you write a book, and boom, you know, it's published. And it's so many stories go into writing the book. And sometimes people do write a book quickly, but most of the time it generally doesn't happen that way. And so, yeah, that's a very important point in how the book won so many wonderful in reviews, such as Plague of Flies, Revolt of the Spirits, 1846, is a thoroughly engaging, unique novel. The historical facts of early California are intact, with fresh new images that ring true. It's a love story and a history with elements of fantasy that make it read like a fairy tale. I loved it, said Jane Kirkpatrick, award-winning and New York Times best-selling author of The Healing of Natalie Curtis. That's a wonderful, wonderful review.
Yes, and Jane Kirkpatrick, of course, writes stories about women in the West. And she is really wonderful. And I've known her for many years. And she is just an author I really admire and respect. And so the fact that she would endorse my book and that she liked it just meant so much to me.
Well, I think this one is important, too. Originality is a hallmark of Miss Hill's work, and Plague of Flies, Revolt of the Spirits, 1846, is no exception. Grounded in history and society of old California that is too often disregarded, it is an outstanding novel about coming of age and finding one's place in the world. Alan Beats, Borderlands Books. And
yes.
I think that's a really wonderful tribute as well, because people really don't know the true history of California and how we got to where we are today.
Yeah, and a lot of people, even raised in California, were not taught in school about what really happened when California became part of the United States. I mean, if you go back into the history of what was called Alta California, it belonged, of course, and originally it was claimed by the Spaniards. It was claimed by Spain. And so Mexico separated, declared its independence from Spain way back in the first third or so of the 19th century. But then they were kind of estranged from Spain because they had done so, and so that France wouldn't establish trading with them because France, you know, was together with Spain. They were allies. So it kind of left California out on a limb for a while. And so many people don't know what the Americans did when they took over California, that this didn't just take California as we know it today. Alta California covered the territory of today's California, plus Nevada, plus Utah, plus part of Wyoming, plus part of California, plus part of New Mexico. It was a huge land grab. I mean, it was a huge land grab. And they were ruthless in doing it. They had no qualms about actually committing genocide against the Native Americans. I mean, the Spaniards had done some awful things, too, with the Native Americans. But I think basically that the people from the United States were worse. And it was just not a good situation at all. And, of course, the experience with my family and their loss of property happened after 1846. It happened in the early 1860s. And we don't know exactly why it happened, but the chief rumor spreader in one of those generations who... I really can't believe her word, but it's plausible, said that the railroads had stolen her land.
Oh, that's very plausible, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so it's even plausible today with having this domain.
Oh,
sorry,
yeah.
I was thinking freeway through here. Pack your bags. Yeah. It's, I mean, seriously, it's been, I'm glad you brought that up, because it's like a never-ending story of greedy people trying to steal land and kill people and commit genocides and do all these horrible things for power and control. And it seems like it's been from the beginning, and I'm glad you brought it all up, because I don't think most people realized all that. And then... I mean, it still continues to this day where this greedy people who want to control the whole planet and reduce the population. So it really kind of makes you feel like, wow, how far have we really progressed here?
Yeah, and there is an excellent book out there for people who want to read about early California in perspective of the involvement of the of U.S. citizens, and that is Benjamin Madley's An American Genocide.
Oh.
And that, it's a real hard book to read because it's gut-wrenching, but it just really opens the eyes. And if even a part of it was true, it would be bad enough. And I'm pretty sure that, I mean, this is a nonfiction book, and I'm pretty sure that Benjamin Madley was telling the truth, because it's just so well done. I think the worst thing that happened is the realization, I mean, for me, the worst realization was that during a very short period of like maybe 30 years or so, maybe 35, I'd have to go back and look it up, that the U.S., citizens of the U.S., reduced the Native American population of California from about 150,000 to less than 17,000, and it was done through genocide. Just,
oh my God,
killing men, women, children, babies on cradle boards, you know, and it's just horrid. It's horrid.
You know, what's interesting is that, you know, we always hear about other countries like Germany and the Nazis and Hitler, you know, bad guys. They're the bad guys. Russia's the bad guys. Germany's the bad guys. But it's always good to look in your own closet first,
mm-hmm,
and find out what happened in our own country and how we got to where we are today, and what's happening in the world and in this country today and all of Western civilization. So I'm so happy that you brought that information up, and I'm definitely going to look up that book as well. And I'm looking right now at Plague of Flies, Revolt of the Spirits, 1846. And tell me quickly, what did the Black Stallion have to do with Catalina?
Okay, that is the Black Andalusian Stallion, who carries spirit riders. He's a spirit horse. He carries spirit riders through the sky.
Ah.
And that horse has no wings. Now, this is where the magical realism and the historical fantasy comes into play. And I tried so hard to get close to Catalina as she believed and how she saw things that she could believe in spirit horses, and thereby, because she believed, the reader would believe from that it was not impossible in that story world that I created. And I think I've succeeded in that. I've gotten some excellent reviews lately. I've got three five-star reviews from Reader's Favorites. I got a good review from Kirkus. I got excellent reviews from San Francisco Reviews and Manhattan Reviews. And I'm just really happy that I managed to accomplish making Catalina's belief in these things allow the reader to be in the story and not be thrown out of the story by the stallion who flies through the sky.
That's wonderful. And so what lessons will the audience learn from your books?
I hope they'll learn insight.
Mm-hmm.
Insight on things that go on, insight about our culture, about other cultures, respect to have reinforced that all people should be respected, that not just people our own color, not just people are from our own culture, that all people are worthy of respect. And in that, that each individual, it's okay to respect and love yourself as well. Because that's part of it. If you can respect yourself and what you do, I think it's easier for you to respect others, to see yourself as part of the whole human population, and you are all fundamentally equal in the sight of a higher power.
Yes, God of the universe, and that's a beautiful message, and I agree with it 100%. So what tips would you give to young writers, adult writers, and what writing advice would you give to them? Because there's plenty of people out there who maybe they don't want to write a story for the world to read, or maybe they just want to do it for their own satisfaction, or maybe they want to leave it for their family. Like my family says, oh, you got to write those stories down. You got to write them down and leave them for us, you know. And so I'm sure there's millions of people like that. And then there's others who do want to have their books out in the public. So what are some of the tips and suggestions you would give to them?
The first tip I have is do it. Start writing. Don't start writing tomorrow. Don't start writing next week. Don't wait till next day or next year or whatever. Start writing now. And it doesn't have to be a lot. You can get out your computer and write on that. You can get out a tablet or a piece of binder paper and write on that. You can record it into your phone. Just do it. And it doesn't have to be, oh, I'm going to start with a great American novel. Look around yourself. See how you perceive how something looks. See how you perceive things with your senses. The smell, the taste, the eyes, the, you know, everything. Look at a person. Listen to another person speak. What hits you about that person? What hits you about what they say, what they do, who they are, who they aren't? And just start to write things down. Write down comments. And eventually there's going to be a character that comes into your head that's going to establish itself and want its story told, his or her story told, or any of the other gender descriptions. The story is going to ask to be told. And then you start connecting things you've written, using things like that. And you don't have to start at the beginning. You don't have to start at the end. You can start in the middle. You can start anywhere you want. You just need to start. And that's the secret. Do it.
That is a great two words, just do it. And, Laurel Ann Hill, I have totally enjoyed hearing about your popular book, Plague of Flies, and about your part of your life and your family. It's been fascinating. And so now's your time to shine, to let our audience know if you have any websites, if they can contact you, and where they can buy your books and so forth.
Well, my website is laurelannhill.com. And there's no www in it. You can just do the HTTPS and the colon and the slashes and then laurelannhill.com and A-N-N-E for my middle name there. And it's all one word. There's no dots, no anything like that in between Laurel Ann Hill. So that's the first place to start. You can go to Amazon and you'll find it. Plague of Flies, Revolt of the Spirits, 1846, Laurel Ann Hill. You can go to Barnes & Noble online and find it. You can go to Borderlands Books in San Francisco. You can look them up, give them a call, and they will get you a signed copy. If you want a signature, I'll go over to San Francisco and sign it.
That's wonderful.
And so there's a whole bunch of options there.
Well, that's fantastic. And Laurel Ann Hill, it was a pleasure talking to you today. I hope you'll come back and talk to us about one of your other books. And I hope your whole year of the new year, 2022, is totally successful for you, more successful than you've been, which is a hard thing to achieve since you've won so many beautiful awards, and congratulations on that. And,
well, we're just going to see what happens with this book. It's whatever's to be. I did my best.
You did a great job, and I'm sure people are going to give you great additional great reviews, because it's already started out with great reviews. So congratulations on that. And everyone, go out and get Plague of Flies, Revolt of the Spirits, 1846, Laurel Ann Hill, Ann with an E. Thank you so much, Laurel, and take care and keep up the good work.
And thank you so much again for inviting me. I really enjoyed our conversation.
Thank you. I'll talk to you again. Bye-bye.
Oh, okay. Bye-bye now.
And Laurel Ann Hill has left the building, and we're going to enter into the wonderful world of issues of the day and find out exactly what is happening and some of the important issues that are affecting our lives and people around the world. So hang on, we'll be right back after this important message.
Howdy, folks. Just stopped in by my favorite restaurant, the Horseshoe Cafe. I highly recommend the home-cooked hot meals and piping hot coffee. In fact, it reminds me of my mom's home cooking when I was growing up. The customer service is excellent. Be sure to save room for the world's best desserts. Make sure you try a slice of fresh homemade pie. The Horseshoe Cafe is located at 154 East 4th Street in the heart of Benson, Arizona. The Horseshoe Cafe is right outside of Tombstone, Sierra Vista, and Tucson. Sometimes Patty and Mike stop by to welcome you. The staff at the Horseshoe Cafe looks forward to seeing you. Stop by to eat or relax. Cool down in the desert with a cold beer or your favorite cocktail. That's the Horseshoe Cafe. Oh, and don't tell anyone I told you. But some people think it's haunted. One thing is for sure. Be sure to bring your appetite.
Columbo Chronicles Live. Columbo is on their trail. Listen up at Columbo Chronicles Live.
Hi, everyone. We're back on Columbo Chronicles Live. And I wanted to provide you with some information today on part two about remdesivir. It's actually Veklury, V-E-K-L-U-R-Y, remdesivir. And FDA and CDC and WHO all refer to it as remdesivir, as did President Trump. And so here's some information that you should ask your doctor about. It says, important safety information, contraindication. Veklury remdesivir is contraindicated in patients with a history of clinically significant hypersensitivity reactions to Veklury remdesivir or any of its components. Warnings and precautions. Hypersensitivity, including infusion-related and anaphylactic reactions. Hypersensitivity, including infusion-related and anaphylactic reactions, has been observed during and following administration of Veklury remdesivir. Monitor patients under close medical supervision for hypersensitivity reactions during and following administration of remdesivir symptoms may include hypotension, hypertension, tachycardia, bradycardia, hypoxia, fever, dyspnea, wheezing, angioedema, rash, nausea, diaphoresis, shivering, slower infusion rates, maximum infusion time, 120 minutes, can potentially prevent these reactions. If a severe infusion-related hypersensitivity reaction occurs, immediately discontinue Veklury remdesivir and initiate appropriate treatment. And the reason I wanted to bring this up is because everyone should be asking their doctor to hand them a information form or explain verbally to them what are the direct adverse side effects of any prescription drug. And this one, of course, is what the FDA and CDC and WHO are pushing. And in the hospitals and in the nursing homes, increased risk of transaminase elevations. I don't know exactly how to pronounce that. Transaminase, let's say, elevations have been observed in healthy volunteers and in patients with COVID-19 who received Veklury remdesivir. These elevations have also been reported as a clinical feature of COVID-19. Perform hepatic laboratory testing in all patients. Consider discontinuing Veklury remdesivir if ALT levels increase to 10 times ULN. Of course, those are medical initials. Discontinue Veklury remdesivir if ALT elevation is accompanied by signs of symptoms of liver inflammation. Risk of reduced antiviral activity when co-administered with chloroquine or hydroxychloroquine. Co-administration of Veklury remdesivir with chloroquine phosphate or hydroxychloroquine sulfate is not recommended based on data from cell culture experiments demonstrating potential antagonism, which may lead to a decrease in the antiviral activity of Veklury remdesivir. Well, when I read that, I was concerned because CDC and WHO and FDA and NIH, Dr. Fauci, prohibited Americans and doctors from using hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin on patients in hospitals and nursing homes, and buying them over the counter, as you used to be able to buy hydroxychloroquine over the counter, or having a prescription filled by the pharmacist. So many doctors have stated that they have used these products successfully and with no direct adverse health effects, and the patients were cured. And so those doctors who have been working with COVID patients and respiratory ailments and asthma and COPD and pneumonia and so forth have stated that they have used those FDA 100% approved safe and effective and ivermectin on their patients, and their patients were cured and lived. So the FDA and NIH and CDC and WHO approved Veklury remdesivir, and then again, I will read what it says here. Risk of reduced antiviral activity when co-administered with chloroquine or hydroxychloroquine. Co-administration of Veklury remdesivir with chloroquine phosphate or hydroxychloroquine sulfate is not recommended based on data from cell culture experiments demonstrating potential antagonism, which may lead to a decrease in the antiviral activity of Veklury remdesivir. So I'm just wondering if that is the reason that they removed the the FDA approved hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin from the shelves, from the pharmacies, from the hospitals and the nursing homes when they announced COVID-19 and only recommended Volkeri's remdesivir. It also says drug interaction trials of Volkeri, remdesivir, and other concomitant medications have not been conducted in humans. And let me go down here. There are insufficient human data on the use of Volkeri, remdesivir during pregnancy. Pregnant women hospitalized with COVID-19 are at risk for serious morbidity and mortality. Volkeri, remdesivir should be used in pregnancy only if the potential benefit justifies the potential risk for the mother and the fetus. Lactation. It is not known whether Volkeri, remdesivir can pass into breast milk. Breastfeeding individuals with COVID-19 should follow practices according to clinical guidelines to avoid exposing the infant to COVID-19. So you can read this on their own website, Volkeri, remdesivir. And you can actually find out for yourself if it's right for you or if you're pregnant or if it's right for children or not, and what are the direct adverse health effects that you aren't being told about. And let's see here. Hold on 1 second. And then it says that the mortality rate on the CDC site in the United States in 2020, life expectancy for the United States population in 2020 is now lower. It used to be 78, now it's 77.0. a decrease of 1.8 years from 2019. The age-adjusted death rate increased by 16.8% from 715.2 deaths per 100,000 standard population in 2019 to 835.4 in 2020. Age-specific death rates increased from 2019 to 2020 for each age group 15 years and over. 9 of the 10 leading causes of death in 2020 remained the same as in 2019, although 5 causes switched rank. Heart disease and cancer remained the top 2 leading causes, and COVID-19 became the 3rd leading cause of death in 2020. Jeanette, to you and to the medical field and CDC and WHO and NIH and Big Pharma, is why would you remove FDA-approved, safe and effective, called a miracle drug for 70 years, even sold over the counter, used by doctors and nursing homes and hospitals to help cure COVID and other respiratory ailments, as well as ivermectin, which doctors say they've used, who are silenced from social media and MSM and BBC, and only the doctors who agree with CDC, WHO, and NIH and Big Pharma appear to have been the only people who can speak out in favor of their protocols. But these other doctors who are silenced, credentialed for many, many, many years and have case studies of the effectiveness of hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin, which is used for horses and humans. There's many medications that are used for both animals and humans, believe it or not. It's not unusual, as MSA made a big deal out of it. It's not unusual. And so if they're approved by the FDA as 100% safe and effective, and doctors around the world say they've used it and they've never had a problem with it or rarely had a problem with it, very rarely. Why would they prohibit the sale of these two approved FDA products as safe and effective? And then the more expensive product, Volkerie Remdesivir, manufactured by Gilead, who manufactures very expensive prescription drugs, be used in hospitals and nursing homes, knowing there's a bigger profit rate, profit margin for the hospitals and the nursing homes to use remdesivir with direct adverse side effects versus the 100% and ivermectin FDA approvals. How does that make any sense? The infant mortality rate decreased 2.9% in 2020 from 2019 to record low 541.9 infant deaths per 100,000 live births. In 2020, the life expectancy at birth was 77 for the total U.S. population, a decrease of 1.8 years from 78.8 years in 2019. So in 2019, in January, is when Fauci announced COVID-19 and as a pandemic. And that's when they took over the country and told us what we can and can't do, locked us down. Millions of people lost their jobs and their businesses, their American dream. Many lost their homes. Many committed suicide during those lockdowns. Because they couldn't feed themselves or their families and couldn't pay for their bills to keep a roof over their heads. And those that took the government's offer of not paying your rent or paying half of your rent didn't tell you that once the mandate was lifted off of the landlords, that you had to come up with that money and pay your landlord. So it's not as great as it appeared to people when they didn't pay their rent. But most people couldn't afford to pay their rent. The choice between food and medicine and utilities and gasoline. 21, according to VOA News, is on track to surpass 2020. As America's deadliest year. U.S. health officials say 2021 is shaping up to be even deadlier than last year. 2021 is when they rolled out the jabs, the experimental and trial injections. And as there's an increase in heart attack, many people are reported online to have died after the jabs from heart attacks, strokes, myocarditis, neurological injuries, and many have reported they were paralyzed. Their whole life, healthy bodies were changed, and many people have died after the jabs are rolled out because the insurance companies who sell group insurance and morticians have been online stating there's a 40% increase in the deaths since the experimental and trial injections have been rolled out and the mandates to jab everyone on the planet, including babies, pregnant women, children, teenagers, young people, young military men and women, medical staff. After the FDA and Dr. Fauci published a long list of the direct adverse health effects and the unknown consequences to individuals after they are jabbed with an experimental and trial injection, such as paralysis, heart attacks, strokes, neurological injuries, profuse bleeding around the brain, paralysis, Guillain-Barr syndrome, and it goes on and on and on. And why would the Congress and the DHHS give the investors in Big Pharma and the CEOs of the Big Pharma manufacturers such as Pfizer and Moderna, J&J, and AstraZeneca, and all of the distributors and all of the marketers and packaging companies and investors, give them 100% immunity from injuries and death, no matter how many people die or are permanently injured from the experimental and trial injections with a Pfizer trade secret formula. So the government is so grossly negligent that they don't even know what they're injecting into the bodies of Americans and every other person who's being mandated to be jabbed over in Europe and Canada and Australia, that tyrannical government who is treating their citizens like prisoners, like lepers, on the way to concentration camps. Same in Canada, where they don't want their non-vaxxed people with these experimental and trial injections who refuse and resist to be used as a human lab rat and human collateral should they die after jab. They can't even buy groceries. So they're going to starve them to death instead. How is that health care? How is any of this about health care and not about controlling the population and about overthrowing the United States Constitution in America with a vaccine passport that overthrows the United States Constitution and denies Americans free choice to control their own bodies and minds and that of their minor children, free will, freedom, liberty, rights, the pursuit of happiness, the pursuit to life, all these granted as a natural, alienable right at birth from God, not from President Biden, not from any president, whether it be Trump, Biden, or any other president, not from a vice president, not from the Congress, not from any elected officials or appointed officials, but an inalienable right, natural right, granted from God to be a free human being with a free will and a free choice to control your own body, your own choices about yourself and your minor children. Who granted the public schools the authority to excessively jab children with experimental trial injections repeatedly? Or your parents or your grandparents who have dementia or Alzheimer's or are in nursing homes or hospitals and you have no control over them? And who granted the right of the government or Big Pharma or Medicare or whoever is involved in granting financial incentives in the tens of thousands of dollars every COVID patient recorded who dies in a hospital or nursing home and is recorded as a COVID patient? Isn't that a bribe? Or they just changed the name to financial incentive? Well, that's an incentive to pull a plug on weak people who are greedy and have no empathy for elderly people or children, teenagers, or for anyone for that matter. Everything should be a choice before that anything is injected into your body. You should have the right to know exactly what they're injecting into your body, even the trade secret formula. And what does the mRNA do to your body. It's never been used on human beings before. You should have the right, and they should provide you with a list of the direct adverse health effects. And there would be different ones for babies and pregnant women and children. And also, you should have the right to consent or opt out. And that's all we have time for. But those are things to think about, because the death rate, the age span should be increasing, and instead it's decreasing. And that should bother everyone. So on that note, say God bless you. God bless America. God bless our military men and women. God bless our first responders, our law enforcers. And may God put his hand on America, and may he change the hearts and minds of those who are being seduced by financial incentives and who have lost their way and are believing that people who ask questions about what they're injecting into one's body, they are not the enemy. They are the messengers. They are the intelligent people who should not trust big pharma, experimental and trial injections, and secret trade, secret formula that they want to cover up for 75 years. Why would they want to do that? This is America. You have a right to think for yourself, to do critical thinking, to do research, to do homework, and to demand that your public servants answer these questions. It's your body, not their body. How many of them were injected with B12 or say, God bless you, and stay healthy, stay happy. And remember, you get less wrinkles from laughing than being angry and being unhappy. So always smile, and it's free. And smile at someone who looks sad and make them smile back. Bye-bye.
Rose Colombo is signing off, and she's left the building. Be sure to bookmark and share Colombo Chronicles Live every Wednesday from 8 to 9 p.m. on the West Coast. Or if you're sleepless in the big city, that would be 11 to midnight on the East Coast. Rose Colombo says, remember, you're never alone when you tune in every Wednesday to Colombo Chronicles.